Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. So we speak a little slowly, using simple sentences and a limited vocabulary. On the show today, we listen to an excerpt of an interview with the former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Benazir Bhutto. She was the first woman leader of that country. She was killed by a suicide attacker in 2007. Bhutto was 54 years old when she died. The interview with Benazir Bhutto is part of the podcast series What It Takes from the American Academy of Achievement. You can find the full podcast and others on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. But first, here is Phil Dierking with a report on the history of clowns and their recent rebirth in American pop culture.
Clowns are almost everywhere these days in popular culture. They can be seen in movies, on television shows, at musical performances, and sometimes just walking in the streets. Clowns are perhaps best known for performing in traveling circuses. They have been making crowds laugh for generations. But what they represent in popular culture has changed a lot over the past 400 years. Clowns have existed in different forms for a long time. Researchers have found evidence of clowns in ancient Rome, China, and even Africa. Their job was to make the ancient rulers laugh. At least one Native American group, the Hopi tribe, also has a tradition involving clown-like characters. Clowns began appearing in the form we recognize today in the 17th century as a character known as a harlequin. They were common in European theater and played a character who acted foolish or played tricks. A harlequin wore colorful clothing and covered his face with a mask to protect his identity.
Clowns from Europe arrived in North America after England began exporting circuses with their clowns, other performers, and trained animals. Starting in the early 1900s, circus shows were very successful in the United States. In the 1950s and 1960s, the popularity of clowns grew because of television. Bozo the Clown appeared in a number of TV programs for children. Also in the 1960s, McDonald's, the fast food business, chose a happy clown to appear in its advertisements. Today, that company mascot, Ronald McDonald, is world famous. However, the image of a happy clown is largely an American creation. So says Benjamin Radford, who wrote a book called Bad Clowns. In other cultures, he says, the clown character is not necessarily good. It's a mistake to ask, when did clowns go bad? Because clowns were never really good. Clowns have always been ambiguous. The clown character originally is a trickster figure. You can't easily categorize them. Is it somebody who is going to make me laugh or attack me? Radford said that, at first, clown shows were meant for adults, not children. In fact, clown characters were meant to be a critique of society or projections of the fears and concerns of everyday people. One example is Mr. Punch, a clown puppet character. It was popular in British and French theaters during the 1700s and 1800s. While Mr. Punch was funny, he was also violent, often hitting his wife during the show. In the 18th century, English actor Joseph Grimaldi became famous for playing a clown in theaters. Grimaldi himself was reported to be an alcoholic and suffered from depression. Literature experts say Charles Dickens remembered those qualities when he created a clown character in his book, The Pickwick Papers. The character made people laugh, but was sad and lonely when he left the theater.
The idea of clowns frightening people started gaining strength in the United States during the 1970s, partly because of John Wayne Gacy. Gacy was a registered clown in the Chicago, Illinois area. He performed for children as a clown character called Pogo the Clown. But between 1972 and 1978, Gacy killed more than 35 young men. He was eventually arrested for the killings. While in prison, he painted many pictures of clowns, including himself as Pogo. Some newspapers began calling Gacy the killer clown. In the 1980s, evil clowns began appearing in movies like Poltergeist and Killer Clowns from Outer Space. In addition, the Stephen King book It was made into a television miniseries. Probably the most famous evil clown character is the Joker character from recent Batman films. Then, in the autumn of 2016, many Americans began developing real concerns about clowns. Starting in South Carolina, people reported seeing individuals wearing clown costumes, often hiding in the woods or in cities at night. Some people said the clowns were trying to lure children into empty homes or the woods. Soon, there were reports of threatening-looking clowns trying to frighten both children and adults. Although there were usually no reports of violence, and many of the reported sightings were later found to be false, this caused a nationwide panic. Even today, clowns have continued to play a strong presence as a dark or violent character. This year alone, a clown is the central villain in the movie version of It, which earned $123 million in its opening weekend. In addition, the current season of the TV series American Horror Story has a number of killer clowns.
While clowns may be popular in the media, the attention is not always wanted. For people who work as or are training to be clowns, the bad clown image does not make their job easier. In 2008, British researchers asked 250 children about clowns. The boys and girls were 4 to 16 years of age. The University of Sheffield survey found that most children did not like clowns, while many feared them. This does not surprise David Carlyon. A historian, he once worked as a clown for the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus.
My theory, based on the evidence, is that the image of the clown as the little kid's friend and as the ideal of sweetness and light became so overblown, so inflated, that it had to be popped.
For most people who work as clowns, their job is to make people happy and laugh. Zach Steele trains future clowns at the Clown School in Los Angeles, California. Steele says he and his students choose to ignore the attention around bad clowns.
If I spent all my time trying to combat that and telling those people to be quiet, I would have no time to do anything else, to actually pursue what clown actually is, which is a positive, creative, imaginative presence in our lives, a manifestation of all of our desires to pursue pleasure and pursue fun and connect with each other on those levels.
Lisa Long, known as CeCe the Clown, says she is sure that clowns still have a bright future.
How often do you get a chance to really laugh or be silly and have fun? I think people are attracted to that, to the laughter. And what I do as a professional children's entertainer is I bring that sometimes to children who may not have had a chance to even laugh that day or that week. And the opportunity to bring laughter, I think that's what attracts people to clowns.
She adds that as long as there are still children in the world, there will still be a future for clowns. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Phil Dierking.
Earlier this month, the Italian city of Pisa held the first international festival of robotics. During the festival, a robot did something incredible at Pisa's Verdi Theater. It lifted a baton and conducted the Lucca Philharmonic Orchestra. The orchestra featured the famous Italian singer Andrea Bocelli. The robot is named Yumi, from the phrase, you and me. It learned all of the necessary movements from Andrea Colombini, the orchestra's usual conductor. Colombini held the robot's arms while the orchestra practiced so that the computer could memorize the correct movements. We basically had to find time to understand his movements. When we found the way, everything was pretty easy, said Colombini. Colombini added that the robot's technicians were very good. They made everything perfect, especially in the length and the speed of the gesture, which is very important, he said. Yumi is not able to act in unexpected ways. He would have been unable to answer a sudden change in tempo by the musicians. Yumi successfully conducted 3 of the 18 musical works performed that night, including one famous song from Verdi's opera, Rigoletto. I'm John Russell.
Man, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement's Recorded Collection. I'm Alice Winkler. For today's episode, we pulled an interview from the vault that is profoundly inspiring, but also unsettling. The interview is with Benazir Bhutto, Pakistan's former prime minister, and it's unsettling because her words take on a painful resonance when you realize that she spoke them in exile 7 years before she was assassinated by a suicide bomber. Here's a news clip from that shocking day in 2007.
We begin with the assassination that is reverberating around the world. Pakistan's former prime minister, Benazir Bhutto, made her triumphant return from exile just 2 months ago. It ended today in horror as she was struck down only 12 days from an election it was widely expected she would win.
Benazir Bhutto was the first elected female leader of a Muslim nation. She was also one of the youngest heads of state ever, becoming prime minister at the age of 35. She served in that role twice, in the late 1980s and again in the mid-90s. She was devoted to democracy and to modernizing Pakistan. She tried to tackle her country's deep poverty and gender inequality, and she was adamantly opposed to violence of any sort.
When I was a very young child, I remember I was always against violence. It was an era when people used to go shooting and hunting. And I remember once coming out on the veranda in our home in the countryside, and my father was teaching my brother to shoot a parrot. And I remember seeing the parrot fall down dead and bleed. And I remember being appalled by it, the parrot fluttering. And I can't bear to see blood to this day or killing. And I'm very much against war and conflict and the taking of life. And I think that seeing that little bird, green and beautiful and living and chirping in the tree, and then falling down dead, did have a profound effect. It sounds silly to say that one should feel so strongly about a bird, but I remember my father telling me when he was facing the death sentence that I remember the little girl who cried so much because a bird died, how she must feel.
Benazir Bhutto's father was Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, an extremely popular statesman. During the 1970s, he served as both Pakistan's president and its prime minister. He was overthrown by a military dictator and was executed just days after Benazir returned home from Oxford University. But in this interview with the Academy of Achievement, Benazir Bhutto began her story before all of those events, describing the Pakistan she was born into in 1953, a country with few cars and extreme poverty.
The gap between the rich and the poor was greater too. I remember people walking barefoot and bare-backed because of the poverty. It was a very privileged life that we led, with huge homes and scores of staff, with everything looked after. Now the world has changed much more. There's a greater appreciation of each human being equal and entitled to the same opportunity, as well as emphasis on human dignity. In those days, there was much less dignity. I remember that the poorer people would greet the richer people by bending down and touching their feet or prostrating them and throwing themselves on the feet. So it was a totally different kind of world, and it's changed for the better in that sense.
Even as a child living in luxury, Bhutto said, she was aware of the disparities.
But my father was always championing the cause of the poor. He was very much against the status quo. So he was always telling us that it's wrong that there should be people in such abject poverty, unable to feed their children. I mean, I'd be sitting there when women would come to my mother and say, take our children, we can't feed them. My father was a lawyer. I remember him coming back and saying that a man came and said, I don't have any money to pay you for this case, some murder case he'd been involved in. And he said, take my cow because I don't have any money. And that was the cow that would give the milk to feed the children. So it was quite shocking to me. And I was sensitive to it because my father was sensitive to it. And he'd take us, we were landowners, large landowners, and he'd take us to the lands. And he would tell me, look at the way these people sweat in the heat and in the sun in the fields. And it is because of their sweat that you will have the opportunity to be educated. And you have a debt to these people because they weren't born to sweat like this. And you have a debt and you've got to come back and pay that debt by serving your people.
The Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe. Part 2.
It was in Paris in the summer of 1840 that I met Auguste Dupin. Dupin was a strangely interesting young man with a busy, forceful mind. He seemed to look right through a person and uncover their deepest thoughts. Sometimes Dupin seemed to be not one, but two people. One who coldly put things together, and another who just as coldly took them apart. One morning, in the heat of the summer, Dupin showed me once again his special mental power. We read in the newspaper about a terrible killing. An old woman and her daughter, living alone in an old house in the Rue Morgue, had been killed in the middle of the night. The story in the paper went,
Paris, July 7th, 1840. Early this morning, cries of terror were heard in the western part of the city. They reportedly came from a house on the Rue Morgue, in which the only occupants were a Mrs. L'Espanier and her daughter Camille. Several neighbors and a policeman ran to the house. By the time they reached it, the cries had stopped. They forced the door open. As they entered, they heard two voices, apparently from above. The group searched but found nothing until the fourth floor. There they came to a door locked from the inside. Quickly, they forced it open. Before them was a bloody horror scene. The room was in total disorder, broken chairs and tables, and the mattress pulled from the bed. Blood was everywhere, on the walls, the floor, the bed. A sharp knife lay on the floor in a pool of blood. In front of the fireplace was a clump of long gray hair, also bloodied. It seemed to have been pulled straight out of a head. On the floor were four pieces of gold, an earring, several silver objects, and two bags containing a large amount of money in gold. Clothes had been thrown around the room. A lockbox was found left open with just a few old letters and papers inside. There was no one there, but when the group inspected the fireplace, they discovered another horror. A still warm body had been forced up the chimney. It was the old woman's daughter. There was blood on the face and dark, deep finger marks on the neck, suggesting a strangling. After searching the house thoroughly, the group went outside. They found the body of the old woman behind the building. Her neck had been cut so severely that when they tried to lift the body, the head fell off.
The next day, the newspaper offered to its readers these new facts.
Paris, July 8, 1840. The police have questioned many people about the vicious murders in the old house on the Rue Morgue, but none of the answers revealed the identity of the killers. Pauline Dubourg, a washwoman, said she has known both of the victims for more than 3 years and washed their clothes. She said, "The two seemed to love each other dearly. They always paid her well. She did not know where their money came from," she said. "She never met anyone in the house. Only the two women lived on the fourth floor." Pierre Moreau, a shopkeeper, said Mrs. L'Espanier had bought food at his shop for almost 4 years. She owned the house and had lived in it for more than 6 years. He never saw anyone enter the door except the old lady and her daughter. and a doctor 8 or 10 times, perhaps. Many other persons, neighbors, said the same thing. Almost no one ever went into the house. Mrs. L'Espanier and her daughter were not often seen. Banker Jules Mignot said that Mrs. L'Espanier had put money in his bank, beginning 8 years before. 3 days before the killings, she withdrew a large amount in gold. A man from the bank carried it to her house for her. Isidore Musée, a policeman, said that he was with the group that first entered the house. While he was going up the stairs, he heard two voices, one low and soft, and one hard, high, and very strange. The voice of someone who was surely not French, the voice of a foreigner, maybe Spanish. It was not a woman's voice, he said, although he could not understand what it said. But the other voice said softly, in French, "My God." Alfonso Garcia, who is Spanish and lives on the Rue Morgue, says he entered the house but did not go up the stairs. A nervous man, he was afraid he might be sick. He heard the voices. He believes the high voice was not that of a Frenchman. Perhaps it was English, but he said he doesn't understand English, so he is not sure. William Byrd, an Englishman who has lived in Paris for 2 years, also entered the house. He said the low voice was that of a Frenchman, he was sure, because he heard it say, in French, "My God." The high voice was very loud, he said. He is sure it was not the voice of an Englishman, nor the voice of a Frenchman. It seemed to be that of an Italian, a language he does not understand. He said it might have been a woman's voice. Mr. Alberto Montani, an Italian, was passing the house at the time of the cries. He said the screams lasted for about 2 minutes. Montani, who speaks Spanish but not French, says that he also heard two voices. He thought both voices were French, but he could not understand any of the words spoken. All who went in the house agreed that the door to the room on the fourth floor was locked from the inside. It was quiet. They saw no one. The windows were closed and locked from the inside. There is only one stairway to the fourth floor. They said that the chimney opening is too small for escape that way. It took 4 or 5 people to pull the daughter's body out of the chimney. It was 4 or 5 minutes from the time they heard the voices to the moment they entered the room. Paul Dumas, a doctor, says that he was called to inspect the bodies soon after they were found. They were in a horrible condition, badly marked and broken. He said only a man could have caused such injury. The daughter had been strangled, he said.
When we had finished reading the newspaper's report of the murders, we were quiet for a while. Dupin had that cold, empty look that I know means his mind is working busily. He asked me what I thought of the crime. I said I considered it a mystery with no answer. But Dupin responded,
"No, no. No, I think you are wrong. A mystery, yes, but there must be an answer. Let us go to the house and see what we can see. There must be an answer. There must."
That's all the time we have for today's show, but we'll be back tomorrow. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.